New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Aeon Byte interview, and with us, we have the honor and pleasure of being joined by Dr. Rick Straussman to discuss his new book, My Altered States, A Doctor's Extraordinary Account of Trauma, Psychedelics, and Spiritual Growth. Rick, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Miguel. My pleasure.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us, too, we've got Vance Sachi, the Moondog. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm just fine. Looking forward to finding the spiritual aspect of the psychoactive substances.
Awesome. Well, Rick, let's start with, tell us why you decided to write this book, a very personal book. At times I was like, you know, as a recovering addict, I was like, some of this stuff I have confessed, but this is kind of leave it on in AA or therapy, right? But
right,
you decided to let it all out, as they say, put it on the table.
Uncensored, unexpurgated. Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I suppose it was written mostly in the interest of presenting a more balanced view about altered states in general and, you know, psychedelics more specifically. You know, there is a tendency, to glorify the psychedelic state or to demonize it. There isn't a lot of, thorough, balanced exploration of the ins and outs, the ups and downs, the dark and the light of altered states. And I've been keeping notes of my altered states experiences ever since I was a young adult. And I've spent a lot of time in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, dredging up a lot of memories from those days. Yeah, and they're good stories, and I do try to use them as teaching episodes. Like after every one of the narratives, I include a little commentary using the traditions and the disciplines that I've studied and learned about over the years, psychopharmacology, Freudian psychology, Buddhism, and the medieval Jewish philosophers of all things. So I approach each of those, states once I'm done telling them, explaining how they came about, what they mean, what I learned from them, what I didn't learn from them.
Yeah, it's a very enjoyable and powerful read, and like you said, it's got a balance of how to approach it. I'm so glad you wrote down these experiences. Like, I never wrote down my first LSD trip or ecstasy, but I'm glad you did that too. But I was reading the first part of your book, and I'm not sure if you're aware of the concept of the wounded healer in shamanism. The idea that it's an individual who you might say is broken. He's had, especially in these tribes, they've had a near-death experience. They almost died. And somehow they become the leaders of the spiritual troubleshooters of the tribe. The channels are open, as they say. And I'm writing a Elvis book is coming out. I'm writing a David Bowie book. And both were abused as children. Both had experiences. Obviously, one didn't make it. But it's almost like in the wounded healer, their wounds make them understand entheogens in the spiritual world. And sometimes they don't want to be cured because it's their pain that allows them to serve the tribe. And I thought of you that way. Your childhood, do you think your childhood, you were a wounded healer? because of the abuse in your childhood, or?
Yeah, I discuss a number of cases or experiences which involved abuse or imagined abuse or visualizing the dysfunctional dynamics in my family as abusive, even though the specific things may not have occurred as such. Mm-hmm. So there is the wounded healer part, and I think when it comes to psychedelics, if you've had like a horrible psychotic experience and you've pulled through it, I think it can help you empathize with people going through the same thing. One of the reasons I always liked working with very sick, psychotic people is because I could relate to them. I've been there, I've done that, I've worked through it, and I understand your pain, and let's, get together and, try to figure out a way of you getting out of here. It's also on a case, I think, of research being research. My interest in these drugs and these states, dovetails into my interest in chemistry and pharmacology. So once I got stoned on hashish for the very first time, I thought to myself, well, this is chemistry. I was, normal 5 minutes ago. And, now I'm in a completely different space, and it's a result of chemistry. So I synthesized, those two interests in altered states and, chemistry, to develop, my career in psychopharmacology.
Yes. You discuss your first altered state at 19, smoking hashish. You were listening to Santana. Forget what song was it? Just out of curiosity.
Well, it was the album, the first, Santana album, the black and white cover with a lion on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Good album. Good album.
Yeah. Clouds were coming out of my speakers, and I just couldn't believe it. I said, this is new. And I went on a flying carpet ride with my roommate, and we, shared the hallucination. It was completely out there. And I felt, calm and happy for the first time in my life. Completely calm and completely happy. There was no ambiguity, no ambivalence. Yeah, so at the age of 18 or 19 years old, I in a lot of ways determined, my future career. I was interested in the drugs, and I was also interested in the states. So, that's where things kind of began.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. Like you, I remember doing LSD and feeling complete balance, complete okayness. Everything's all right. There was a sense. Yeah, there was a balance in what I've been seeking all my life with the torment of childhood and growing up. But that's always a curious thing, isn't it, Rick? It's like, I remember I listened to a rabbi a few weeks ago, and he said drugs are the solution. And I had to change my thinking, because I always thought drugs is what destroyed my life. But then I realized they made me feel good. They made me feel like I belong, like I could think. So isn't that always the interesting part? Is I tell people drugs is not the solution or the destruction. It's just a portal or a companion. Or what attitude do you have?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would call them, the solution per se, but they can, be an introduction to the solution. Mm-hmm. They could kind of, point you in the direction that your life needs to go. There's a concept in Buddhism called bodhicitta, mm-hmm. Which is the first flash of enlightenment. In other words, it's the experience, that an enlightened state is potentially available to you. And it's your first, glance of that kind of alternate reality, which is much more grounded in reality than everyday, consensus consciousness. So in my case, that occurred on an LSD experience, an LSD trip when I was maybe 19 or 20. Yeah, so it still took me, years and years to discover a, Buddhist organization that I could study with and train with. But still, it was my first intimation of the possibility of an enlightened life, an enlightened state of mind.
Yes, and for the audience, it's not all serious. There's one story with you and LSD, I believe, in the fried chicken. That uh-huh. had me laughing out loud. Could you share with the audience that?
Fried chicken, yeah. Well, yeah, it was the first psychedelic experience, you know, which I'd ever had. It was at a party. At a girl's dormitory. Yeah, and I was tripping for the first time in my life. There was a huge mound of fried chicken in the entryway for us to eat, and I was uncomfortable with the social setting, and retired to sitting on the bed next to the chicken, and I was looking at the chicken and the coleslaw and the potato salad and the beers under the table, and it just was amusing. And then my friends came in and started picking pieces of chicken off of this mountain of chicken, which I had dubbed Mount Chicken. Yeah, and I could not believe that people were eating this chicken. I would say, that's fried chicken, right? And they'd say, yeah. And I'd say, and you're going to eat it? And they'd say, yeah. Yeah. And I was just laughing so hard, I almost peed in my pants, actually. It was just the most absurd thing I had ever, seen.
Yeah, good times when we were in college. And in college, what were some of your defining moments, as you write in your book? I think your manifesto was another pivotal moment in your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the manifesto that occurred when I was it was between my junior and senior years of college. I became kind of messianic, actually. Taking psychedelics. I loved them. I just, loved how I felt. And I thought, well, everybody should feel this good. And I was also, just beginning, to learn about, Buddhism, Freudian psychology, psychopharmacology, I really, didn't know, what to do after graduating from college. Like, all my friends were applying to medical school, mm-hmm. But my medical, career really had, very little interest, didn't have, much appeal. I guess I'm what you might call a typical Aquarian. Mm-hmm. I love humanity, but I'm not that crazy about people. it was one of those kinds of situations. I really wanted to cure mankind's illnesses, their distress, their dysphoria, with drugs, with psychoanalysis, with Zen Buddhism, with psychopharmacology. But the notion of being a doctor and working with individual patients just wasn't that interesting to me. So I was kind of in a bind. I didn't really know what to do. One afternoon, I took some acid, watched the sun go down. It came to me, that I would go to medical school in order to implement this messianic utopian kind of model, which combined all of those things. Yeah. And I just wrote and wrote and wrote. It was, 20 pages of, free association. And, this was 1972, the Controlled Substances Act had passed only a couple of years previously. Mm-hmm. And, psychedelics had become anathema. They were horror drugs. And, what was Buddhism exactly? Like, monks were, self-immolating in Vietnam to protest the war. And, Freud was, falling out of favor, the manifesto was, the basis of my application to medical school. And every chance I got with all of those interviews, which were 21 in total, 19 rejected me because they said, why do you want to be a doctor? And I said, let me tell you. The one school that I actually got into was a very brief interview, just a few minutes, because the interviewer was, very busy. It was a remote interview. I went to medical school, and I got, super depressed because there wasn't anything, similar, to implementing the manifesto in, medical school in the Bronx. I had moved out there, from Northern California. yeah, you know, so my dropout of school as a result of being, you know, pretty depressed, and ended up at the, you know, Zen monastery, which is, you know, the last, you know, chapter in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And how did Zen Buddhism help you? Because even Vance and I were talking a couple of days ago. It's great for emptiness and realizing how pliable the self is. But of course, there's always the danger of nihilism. Everything casts a shadow, as Jung said. But how does it help you, Rick?
Well, a couple of ways, or maybe even three ways. You know, one was that I established a relationship, you know, with a very solid community of, you know, practitioners, you know, very sincere, you know, very dedicated, very kind, very empathic, you know, psychologically sophisticated. Mm-hmm. You know, they were peers, you know, basically, you know, nearly all of them, you know, like me, you know, got their first flash of the potential of an enlightened way of life through psychedelics. And for almost all of them, their big psychedelic experiences were a stimulus, you know, to become Zen monks. You know, so, you know, we shared a lot of experiences and background and perspectives. You know, also, I learned to meditate, you know, which was quite, it was quite practical. You know, like I had gone, you know, to another Zen community on a retreat a few months before that, and it was a Rinzai temple. You know, there's a number of, you know, different, you know, types of Zen Buddhism out there. You know, Rinzai, you know, focuses on what's called koan practice, which is things like what's the sound of one hand clapping, what was your face like before your parents met, those kinds of things. You know, and, you know, those, you know, that kind of a practice, you know, seemed more suitable, you know, to living in a monastery, and, you know, working on your koans. Right. You know, the temple I ended up, you know, studying with was, or is a Soto temple, and you know, the emphasis, or you know, they emphasize, you know, this, you know, the koan of everyday life. Which, you know, for example, is, you know, why does the noisy breathing of your neighbor bothering you, as opposed to what's the sound of one hand clapping? Yeah. You know, they're related. You have to, like, you know, get a grip and, you know, let go of your preconceptions. You know, but it was, you know, much more practical on an everyday kind of basis. And I thought, you know, if, you know, like if I ever do, you know, return to medical school, I can't spend all my time, you know, thinking about these koans. I need to study, and I need to do the dishes, and I need to get a haircut, and I need to, you know, speak to, you know, my classmates and my teachers. You know, so those were the koans, as opposed, you know, to more abstract, you know, kinds of things. And also, you know, my depression lifted, you know, one day. I was, you know, coming back, you know, from a, you know, work, you know, project with some picks and you know, shovels over my shoulder. And, you know, my depression just went away, you know, lifted off of my shoulders over the space of maybe 20 seconds, 30 seconds. It just, you know, came up, it, you know, lifted up off of me. And I thought, that's interesting. I'm not feeling depressed anymore. You know, so I, you know, kept it to myself, you know, finished the day, went to sleep, woke up, and I still felt pretty good. So, you know, up until then, I was thinking, you know, that all I, you know, might be good for was to become a monk. I would just, you know, cloister myself, you know, not interact, you know, with the outside world anymore. You know, that's all I was good for. I'd just be a monk, you know, meditate all day, you know, clean out, you know, the toilets and whatnot. Nice. Yeah. You know, but after my depression lifted, I thought, well, gee, I've been working on all this, you know, medical stuff for all these years, and my interest in, you know, healing and things. Yeah. You know, so within a few days, I decided to return to medical school. You know, my relationships, you know, with the monks was extremely helpful after that too, because, you know, I could ask them questions like, you know, what do I do in a subway if, you know, somebody steps on my foot? It was quite practical. Yeah. And I went back to medical school, and I was, you know, studying machine, like when studying just study. Yeah. And I got great grades and, you know, all of that.
Did you continue the trip? Or had you given that up?
Yeah, I stopped. Like the last couple of months of school, after I was accepted into my residency of choice, I kind of let down my guard a bit and started smoking pot again. Yeah, and I continued during my residency. I tripped a few times as a resident, when I was training, but then then I got back, more seriously into it. Once I moved to New Mexico in, the mid 1980s, I was a member I belonged or, joined in, with a small group of therapists and psychiatrists and lawyers and psychologists, that were, taking, new psychedelics, as well as, the older ones and exploring them interpersonally and spiritually.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, I always suggest people, meditation has really helped my life. Glad you didn't do the spiritual bypassing, as they call it. And your story reminds me of Aldous Huxley when he did peyote and he's like communing with the universe and he's looking over. He's like, oh, somebody's got to clean those dishes in my sink. I got to come down to my life, even though where I am, I'm so much happier. So we all have responsibilities, right, Rick? A mission.
spiritual, bypassing. It's a common thing with, folks who take psychedelics. And it's also, the case with, hardcore meditators. You might have an enlightenment experience and, decide you don't need therapy and you don't need to tidy up your interpersonal relationships. Once I returned to medical school, I realized, I still need help. I found a psychotherapist, worked with him for a couple of years. My speech was causing some problems on rounds, and I got a speech therapist, which was quite helpful. So I was quite grounded in my problems and was interested in dealing with them at a real practical level.
Good deal. Yeah, and in your book you talk about how, and I could relate to this, Rick, you had a sense of, you're always looking for danger and living on the edge, obviously from your childhood. Was it therapy when you're able to identify this sort of characteristic about yourself?
Not initially. It took a couple of years of psychoanalysis later on. Yeah. Which occurred in my early 30s, mid 30s. Yeah. One day my analyst was, describing, the kind of women or, the kinds of situations I was interested in. And he said, exciting, but dangerous. So I learned the hard way about that trait.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And then later on, you went back or started embracing or going back to Judaism. And I love in your book, you talk about Maimonides, a great philosopher. I've always liked everything he's done. So Judaism, mystical Judaism, how did it help you, for the audience?
Well, there were a couple of reasons that I returned to my Jewish roots. Like I was, raised in a conservative, Jewish household. There's like, three main, streams of Judaism. There's Reform, which is quite liberal. There's Orthodox, which is, quite conservative. And, the one in the middle is, called conservative Judaism, even though it isn't as, conservative as Orthodox. I was bar mitzvah, went to a Hebrew day camp in Los Angeles, all that. But then I got my braces off and got contact lenses and started running track and was popular and things. So I stopped my Jewish involvement. One other thing as well is there wasn't much in the way of spirituality in my Jewish education. I was spending 6 hours a week from 5 to 13 in a Hebrew day school or Jewish day school. Yeah, but there wasn't much emphasis on spirituality per se.
Right.
There was culture and, the holidays, the ritual, some of, the Bible, but, mostly historical. There is an emphasis on, World War II, the Holocaust, the establishment of the, State of Israel, but like actual experiential, communing with, the divine was, fairly absent, from the curriculum. I went to college, learned about meditation, learned about Buddhism, and went, whole hog into that. So as I got older and as my, DMT studies progressed, things began to shift. With respect, to the DMT work, my volunteers and I were both expecting a, Kensho like experience, an enlightenment experience, no self, no content, right. No time, no space, no body, no feelings. And, most of the volunteers in the study were practitioners of, some kind of Eastern meditation. So was I, so we all, expected that, DMT is quite, full of content, and you maintain your personality and you interact with your personality with the contents of that state. So in a lot of ways, the opposite of a Kensho experience, Satori. Buddhism, theoretically or, model wise, wasn't really doing it. Plus as I was, growing up, as it were, spiritually, the bowing of the, practice, in a Zen communities, Zen temple, was beginning to bother me. Like these big, golden Buddha statues, bowing to them all the time, bowing to each other, bowing to, Bodhisattva, statues in the hall, bowing to each other. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to be, bowing, I would rather, bow to the Most High, as opposed to statues. Mm-hmm. The story or the explanation was, you're bowing to these qualities in yourself, whatever. But I didn't really buy that, or it just didn't really ring true. Politically, the monastery was becoming increasingly, hierarchical. There were, red monks and yellow monks and white monks and all that, with the different colored robes. The teacher was becoming increasingly inaccessible as well. It was, beginning over time to be like any other religion. The bowing, the lack of a good, model, the bowing and the lack of a good model were, kind of, chafing at me. Mm-hmm. We parted ways over the whole issue of, psychedelic experiences and their relevance, to Buddhist practice. It was okay if we were just speaking one-to-one about these things, but once I actually began, my study, and you began your writing and speaking about, the relationship of psychedelics, to Buddhist practice, it was a hot potato, for the monastery. They just did not want to conflate, drugs and Buddhism. Especially like I'm a member of the community, like was I speaking for them? Those kinds of issues. I said, well, can't we, I said, well, couldn't we just talk about it? And they said, no, this is not science. This is a religion, that we're talking about. And, we don't, challenge, the basic beliefs of religion. You can do that within, the scientific model, mm-hmm. but they're different animals. So we parted ways, kind of uncomfortably, actually. They had, more or less, saved my life, 23 years before. Like I got married there, I helped establish an affiliated meditation group in Sacramento. Yeah, all those things. The master, stayed at my house. once or twice. You know, they gave grand rounds, you know, to psychiatry back then. Yeah, you know, so it was a painful separation, but also it was overdue. You know, the bowing was getting to me, the model, and you know, and also, you know, the increasing, you know, politicalization of the community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so I stumbled upon a book about, you know, Kabbalah in the local bookstore, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. It reminds me of my Jewish upbringing. You know, plus it's much more sophisticated, you know, mm-hmm. than anything I had ever come across as a kid. Yeah, you know, so that, you know, led me to begin, you know, reading the Hebrew Bible. And you can't read the Hebrew Bible, you know, without a scorecard, you know, without a lot of scorecards, because it's a very, you know, difficult, you know, text to crack.
Yeah.
You know, so I began reading the medieval commentators, and then ended up, you know, studying Maimonides, you know, who was this, you know, brilliant, you know, philosopher, physician, you know, community leader, in, you know, 1200s. I think, you know, Fostat, in what was Egypt at the time.
Indeed.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Indeed. So it was the sound of one foot walking out of Zen Buddhism, I suppose. Vance,
you know, more like, you know, one foot giving me the boot.
That's more graphic. Yeah. Vance, do you have any questions, or what do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was curious. Maybe I'm getting ahead of our conversation, but spirit molecule and spirit. What is spirituality for you? What do you mean by spirituality?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good question, but you know, because a lot of, you know, people just, you know, bandy around, you know, the notion of spiritual. Well, you know, it can be described, or, you know, defined in a number of ways. You know, one could be, you know, feelings and ideas, you know, that, you know, relate to, you know, the highest, you know, possible, you know, values, like compassion and love and empathy, charity, you know, justice, you know, those kinds of things. You know, feelings and ideas, which, you know, relate, you know, to those notions. You know, also, I think it, you know, can relate to, you know, things which are usually invisible, you know, but are felt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like spirit, angels, the soul, you know, God, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
You know, so I think it, you know, combines, you know, both, you know, cognitive qualities and emotional perceptual qualities.
So do you think the, you know, psychoactive compounds and so forth actually tap into real spirituality, or the things that you experience on the trips, are those, does it make those entities manifest, you know, to the senses? That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I think any specific or any individual, you know, psychedelic experience is the result of setting and the dose of the drug. You know, so if you're a spiritual person in the first place, and you read spiritual texts, your friends are spiritually oriented, you occupy yourself with spiritual ideas and feelings, you know, then I think, you know, psychedelics, you know, you may give a jump start or amplify, or, you know, they could, you know, turbocharge your interest and experiences of those kinds of things. I think, you know, there is a risk of mistaking, you know, certain, you know, feelings for true spirituality. You know, so, you know, for example, you may feel, you know, love, and you may feel a, you know, sense of you know, those kinds of things, you know, without any, you know, specific object. And you believe that you've become a more spiritual person simply as a result of, you know, having those feelings. You know, but it isn't only, you know, feelings. You need to, you know, have, you know, some, you know, psychological, overlay, as it were. You know, like, what do you love? You know, who do you love? You know, what do you feel empathy for? You know, that I think is, you know, one of those spiritual, you know, bypassing issues, you know, that if you feel enlightened, you know, does that mean you are enlightened? And I think oftentimes it's, you know, just the opposite. You know, so those, you know, kinds of, you know, feelings, I think, need to be, you know, they need to be attached, as it were, you know, to something concrete, you know, that you can actually communicate and think about and relate.
Something that results in actual improvements in your life, something that drives you to be a better person, so to speak.
Yeah, to become a better person and to, you know, hopefully make the world a better place as a result of those experiences.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah, you can manipulate that state in any which way you want, you know, depending on your intention and, you know, the intention of the, you know, folks around you. You know, the, you know, case in point I like, you know, to bring up is, you know, Charles, you know, Manson, and his, you know, followers. Yeah. You know, they took a lot of LSD, and, you know, he just inculcated in them this really strange worldview. And, you know, they followed him, you know, because of the increasing, you know, meaningfulness of those ideas, which were, you know, more or less undeveloped, nascent in their minds in the first place. You know, but under the influence of, you know, psychedelics, they became more solidified and, you know, more meaningful.
Indeed. And yeah, you mentioned setting and control. I think that's an important one. Can you explain a little bit more? Because I think even talking about our lives and experimenting, I think that's a good framework for any sort of entheogen use.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, so the set is, you know, who you are at the time of your experience, your mental health, your physical health, your spiritual health. Your setting is, you know, the circumstances, you know, like, is it indoors, outdoors, with friends or with strangers or with, or with enemies, you know, people, you know, that you're not comfortable with, you know, research environment or spiritual environment, like in the country, in the city, and, you know, the, you know, third leg is, you know, the drug. Is it MDMA? Is it LSD? Is it high potency marijuana? Is it ketamine? Which, you know, also includes the dose. Is it a small dose, a medium dose, or a high dose? You know, so, you know, like I spend a lot of time in my 2022 book, The Psychedelic Handbook. Mm-hmm. You know, the largest of the chapters in that book is about how to trip, you know, how to get ready, you know, how to experience the effects, you know, what to do if you get into any tight spots, and, you know, the, you know, the question of integration, you know, how do you make sense of it and apply it later on?
Definitely check it out. And in your book too, Rick, you talk about studying some altered states, and you bring some of people that I, of course, have read and, let's say, admired, fascinated by, Charles Bukowski, William Burroughs, very Gnostic, big influence on David Bowie. But you also bring Carl Jung, who obviously had his own altered state without psychedelics. What do you think of Jung's Red Book, or has Jung affected your research or even your therapy well-being?
Well, you know, when the Red Book, you know, first came out, I started looking at it, and it just seemed way too much. so I just put it down, and I haven't returned to it. Yeah, you know, my understanding of the Red Book is it's a, you know, collection of, you know, drawings and, you know, musings which occurred over a, you know, 3-year period. You know, of a, you know, fairly altered state. You know, some people, you know, describe it as a spiritual breakthrough. Others as, you know, madness, you know, so, you know, take your pick. Right. Yeah. But Jungian psychology, you know, has never really appealed to me. And, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, one of the reasons is it, you know, treats your life as if it were something else. It isn't your life. It's your relationship to your archetypes. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in private practice, you know, some years back, and it was mostly a psychotherapy practice. I would occasionally pick up patients, who had been in Jungian analysis, and they all talked about their dreams. They didn't talk about their everyday life, which would be very frustrating, to me, like, what about your wife? What about your husband?
What your boss.
What about your bills? Yeah. And they say, it's the Fuere Turnus or it's Ariadne. It's like, not really. It's, like it's you. Yeah. So, that, never really appealed to me. Freudian, psychology was much more attractive because it, deals with your childhood and your current relationships and your relationship with the therapist, very, cut and dried in a lot of ways.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And I know Jung was, he wrote favorably towards entheogens, but I think it was pretty briefly. Again, he was another era. He didn't get to enjoy when it broke through. And what would you say you've been such a pioneer in this field and broken so much open and, the world should be very grateful for all the work you've done. But what do you think, if you had a state or a declaration of how we are today, what would you say, Rick? Because on one hand, yes, psychedelics and therapy through entheogen is just breaking through. It's just, it's accepted more and more. We even had recently Tricia Eastman, and she does a lot of lobbying for psychedelics. And she's like, I can go to both Republicans and Democrats, and they're both very happy to give me money to fund these things. So right. I never thought I'd see the day. At the same time, addiction is higher, depression is higher in the collective. So what are we in a good place or a bad place, or what do you think?
I think it's kind of hanging in the balance. My Zen teacher always used to say it's 51-49. 51 good, 49 bad, which is, a, call, for each individual, to do, what they can. It isn't as if any of us, could be considered insignificant. It is interesting, there is beginning, to be some backlash against, psychedelics. Mm-hmm. Ketamine is becoming better known as an addictive drug in some circumstances. People are reporting more and more adverse effects. Some thorough studies are beginning to reveal the prevalence of adverse effects. Back in the 60s, the psychedelics became wonder drugs. Like everybody said, everybody should trip. They'll help everybody with everything. Yeah. Then they became horror drugs with the demonstrations and all the social unrest which was occurring back then. So they became horror drugs, and after that, they were just forgotten about. So I think, the pendulum is beginning to swing, and, hopefully they won't become horror drugs, and hopefully they won't be forgotten. I think, the scientific, community, learned, from, the mistakes of the past. They're not, like overreaching. But I think at the same time, it's, very appealing, to be considered, like an expert on saving the world, so you can be not especially grounded, and talk about how great psychedelics are, which then sets up unreasonable expectations, which are bound to be dashed. So I think there's still the risk of unscrupulous types exploiting the you know, the enthusiasm. You know, but you know, the scientific community has been more cautious. You know, the media was, you know, kind of glowing early on, Michael Pollan's book and all that. You know, but I think they're starting to cast a more, you know, wary, you know, look at the field. You know, but it still is, you know, like if you were to describe any kind of backlash, it would be, you know, only, you know, the earliest, you know, stages. You know, Vermont, you know, for example, refused, you know, to, you know, legislate, you know, for psychedelic medicine. You know, Massachusetts, you know, did as well. You know, a number of, you know, counties in Colorado, in Oregon are refusing, you know, to let, you know, clinics open, you know, so, you know, there, you know, there is more caution, I think, you know, that we're seeing now.
Yeah. I had a question. Is it, have there been any studies that, look at what kind of effects long-term it has on brain physiology? Is, you know, the old fear that, you know, it's going to be damaging your brain or whatever else like that. What's your view on that?
Yeah. Well, the classical, you know, compounds like LSD, mescaline, you know, psilocybin, you know, DMT, you know, they seem to be, you know, safe, you know, for the brain. If you take them only, you know, here and there, only occasionally, you know, there is, you know, some, you know, theoretical concern about, you know, microdosing every day or every other day, you know, that it may potentially, you know, cause, you know, some, you know, cardiac, you know, problems, especially, you know, with the valves and the heart, you know, but there isn't any human evidence, you know, that that's the case. It's more, you know, theoretical. You know, so MDMA, if you take too much, is neurotoxic. There's not much question about that. Yeah, ketamine, you know, it's unclear, you know, what the long-term effects would be on the brain of repeated you know, ketamine use. You know, there are other, you know, problems like, you know, bladder problems, you know, specifically with overdoing it with ketamine. You know, but, you know, the classic, you know, compounds, you know, seem to be safe. You know, back in the, you know, the horror, you know, the stage of, you know, psychedelics becoming horror drugs, you know, there were, you know, concerns about, you know, chromosome damage, you know, but that never held up. And, you know, the brain, you know, damage, you know, literature was, you know, fairly weak, and, you know, there isn't any evidence.
How about flashbacks?
Yeah, you can have, you know, flashbacks, which are recurrences of certain aspects of the, your psychedelic experience, you know, long after, you know, the drug has worn off. You know, that is, you know, currently, you know, being called, you know, hallucinogen or, you know, post-hallucinogen, you know, perceptual disorder, which I think is a misnomer, you know, because, you know, because, you know, flashbacks, you know, can involve other, you know, modalities other than, you know, purely perceptual. You can have anxiety like you may have felt at certain, you know, times of your trip. You can have deja vu, you know, feel like you're tripping again. You can, you know, so, you know, those, you know, sequelae aren't only, you know, perceptual. You know, they occur. It's, you know, pretty rare, but, you know, they usually occur, you know, with a lot of use, although, you know, there are, you know, cases of them, you know, starting after even one use, especially if it was a, you know, traumatic experience. It, you know, shares a lot with PTSD if it was a, you know, traumatic psychedelic experience. You can, you can feel as if you're, you know, reliving, you know, the trauma of an unpleasant, you know, psychedelic experience. Yeah, I'm not sure what I would, you know, call the, you know, the prevalence. It's under 1% for sure. And, you know, there, and if you read, you know, the research, literature, you know, like, you know, the results of studies which occurred in a research environment. If you can believe, you know, their reports, you know, there haven't been many case reports of flashbacks. If you're screened carefully, your experience is carefully supervised, and you have some time to integrate the experience in the context of some skilled therapists.
All right.
Wonderful. Well, as we get to the end of the interview, Rick, what do you hope the reader will get out of your book? So much we haven't covered, but I enjoyed it. What do you want? What should people understand?
Well, you know, I suppose a couple of things. Don't discount your experience. Both good and bad. Like if you've had a painful experience in your life, don't ignore it. Like pay attention, document it. Or if you've had a positive experience with drugs or with alcohol or being in love or in therapy, you should document it, think about it, chew on it. That's one take home. Like don't deny or minimize the value of all your experiences, as especially the extraordinary ones. I suppose the other is, get help if you need it. Mm-hmm. You can find out if you need help, based on the, the nature of your extraordinary mental states. So, pay attention and get help when you need it, I suppose, the two take homes.
Good advice for sure. Definitely good advice. Vince, any last question from you, or how you doing?
Yeah, I got a bombshell question to end with, which is
bombshell. Well, let me have a drink of water before that.
Good, yeah. So, in all your experiences, did you ever run into the mystical experience? And I mean by mystical, not just the occult, and I'm interested in all these interesting things, but the unitive consciousness type experience?
So one time in particular, I was in the wilderness in it occurred in my early 30s or so. I was in the Gila Wilderness in southwest New Mexico, and I took way too many mushrooms. I had to lay down, and I had a close friend on either side. Yeah. And I just, went into the white light, and I stayed there for maybe half hour or so. Yeah. And, it was interesting. One of the things which came to me, during, that experience, was one of the lines from one of the Zen, scriptures, that we recited every day, which was, even the slightest twitch will surely break the rhythm. Mm-hmm. Every time I pulled back and witnessed and was thinking about the white light, it just kind of went away. And so when I stopped thinking and judging and analyzing and assessing, I went back into it. That became clear to me, the meaning of that verse. Yeah, but that was probably the most striking example of being in the white light for any period of time.
Very good. Very interesting.
Indeed. Thanks for sharing. Well, we are at the end. Yeah, I certainly recommend My Altered States. Good read. I'm glad it came out into the world. But first of all, Vance, thanks for keeping us company on this trip.
Oh, my pleasure. And great to meet you, Dr. Strassman.
Well, thanks, Vance. My pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much for coming on the show, Rick. And I will have this on the show notes. Where do you want to send people? Your website, Inner Traditions?
For starters, they can look at my website, rickstrassman.com. I sell books on my site. I'll inscribe and sign them. Yeah, and you can buy the book or a number of my books you know, through Amazon, you know, through the publisher, mm-hmm. Inner Traditions, you know, Barnes and Noble, you know, the usual suspects.
Indeed. Well, awesome. And again, it's on the show notes right now, whether you're watching this or listening to this on a podcast in the audio version. So check it out. Check out Rick's work. It's important. And we hope it continues to break ground. And yes, thank you very much, Rick, for coming on the show. We appreciate your time and your work and your sharing of your experiences.
Well, sure. Thank you very much, too.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.